But right now, it is always a delight to spend some time with Charles C.W. Cook, National Review. He's got the National Review cover story, How I Fell in Love with America. One of my favorite, if not my favorite person to follow on Twitter. Before we get to anything else, Charles, the film prequel hashtag that you have been weighing in on, you are killing me with these. My favorite thus far, Buchanan.
Yeah.
It took me a half second. I looked at that one. Oh, okay, I got it. But you just reeled off a ton of them. Following Charles, you're going to think, you're going to learn some things, and you're going to laugh as well with some of the stuff he puts up. Charles, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
As people can tell by the accent and by the number of times you've been out with us before.
He's from New Milford.
Yeah, he's from right around the corner here in Illinois. No, you're from across the pond, as they say. And it's a beautiful piece written, again, the cover story on the December 31st edition of National Review, My American Dream, How I Fell in Love with the United States. How long have you been on this side of the ocean, Charles?
Well, I've only lived here for 2.5 years or so. I immigrated in the summer of 2011.
So you and America met on eHarmony, and it just seemed that you had so much in common, it was bound to flower.
Well, it's funny. I've always been to America in my life, and I've always been to attract American friends and even American relatives. They're not actually my relatives, but I have two people I call my American grandmas. One lives in Arizona, another lives in California. And they actually met my parents in Switzerland. It sounds like a novel, doesn't it? They met my parents when they were in Switzerland before I was born. And we kept in touch, and we would go and visit them in California and Arizona as kids. So for some reason, I've always resonated at the American level. It doesn't mean I always was politically conservative or politically pro-American in the classical sense, but I never really bought any of the nonsense as a kid, because unfortunately there is a lot of reflexive anti-Americanism in Europe, and there is some in England, especially in the sort of chattering class environment in which I grew up, and that never really appealed to me at all. So it has been a long love affair in one form or another.
I love what you put up talking about a fairly typical crack about America from Oscar Wilde. America has often been discovered before Columbus, but it had always been hushed up. I'd love to be offended by that, but it's clever enough that I have to laugh at it.
No, it is a good line. But, next to the quote, I put something that I think is a little more sinister, and that is that in the British middle and upper middle classes, there is a tendency to make unfunny jokes or cracks about the United States in a way that those people wouldn't make jokes about anyone else. So people will say things like, oh, Americans are stupid, or Americans are fat, or Americans are violent, or whatever. And you would never hear them say, for good reason, all Indians are stupid. All Indians are fat. If somebody said that at a dinner party or on television, the audience would immediately swivel toward them, and everyone would gasp for making such an ignorant blanket statement about a group of people. And yet, across Europe, unfortunately, it does seem that it's acceptable. It's especially odd when you think about it, because America is actually composed of pretty much every nationality on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So when people say, well, I don't like America, they're almost saying, I don't like humanity.
Well, it's like Bill Murray saying our ancestors were kicked out of every decent country around the world.
Well, they were kicked out of much less decent countries than this. And they came here for a good reason. I live in the Northeast, and I work maybe a mile away from Ellis Island. And I've been there 3 times. It never ceases to move me. And one of the most moving things that I've seen in recent years is a piece of testimony that's in one of the rooms at Ellis Island from an Italian girl, maybe 15, and she wrote that when she got to America, she didn't know where to go within New York, and so she, with trepidation, went and asked a cop, and he just gave her directions. And she says that it was the first time ever that a cop hadn't hit her, effectively. Now, I can't remember why. I can't remember if it was because she was Jewish or because she was poor, because she was from the wrong family. I don't know. But, you know, the joke about being kicked out of society might be true, but really, the majority of the societies that have formed America were not better than this one. And I think Americans do underappreciate the beauty of their country and the principles on which it's founded.
Charles C.W. Cook with us from National Review, nationalreview.com, and it's got the cover piece on the December 31st issue of the print version. You write September 11th was a galvanizing event for you and helped change a little bit of your thinking about taking things for granted, taking everything for granted. You write about stability of the seas, global trade, international peace, and more, largely because of the power of the U.S. Navy, the naval supremacy, and it never occurred to you, and I would imagine many others, what the world might look like or how it would look different if another country or axis of power controlled the seas the way the U.S. does.
Yes, well, this is something that I began to notice after 9/11, as I write, but that really came to the fore when I was at university. People would say that a unipolar world, or a world in which there was just one hegemon, the United States, was a bad thing. And the implication was that they would rather that the Soviet Union were there to somehow check American excess. And I actually like to ask people this when I rarely give talks or lectures or speaker meetings or what you will. I like to ask people this because they don't tend to have thought about it ever. Well, which country would you like instead to be in charge, to be the most powerful, to have control of the seas and provide the international public goods? Would it be France or Russia or China, perhaps? When you really sit and think about it, you realize that many of the things that we take for granted, global trade, relative peace and prosperity, enforcement of the rule of law, and so on and so forth, are, and America's by no means perfect, don't get me wrong, but are the product of 200 years of unbroken naval supremacy, first from the British and then from the Americans picked up after the Second World War. Now, I had never thought about that before. I'd never really understood why people needed big militaries. By the same token, I used to be very much in favor of gun control, which is pretty amusing if you read me now. But I'd never really thought about these questions, and 9/11 brought them all to the fore, and they did change my politics, but also heighten my appreciation of the United States and its role in the world.
Now, you didn't hear, at least if I'm reading you right in your piece, you didn't hear regular disparagement of America at home. It was in other spots.
Yes. No, my family has always been reasonably friendly towards America. My father was in the Royal Air Force in the Huntingdon constituency in that area of England, and it's populated by American air bases. So many of the people on the Air Force bases were USAF, and he's always had a very favorable view of the United States. So I did certainly grow up with that, but I mean, as I say, within chattering class England, there is a sort of casual, flippant, snide, reverse Oedipal complex, if you will, about the United States. But I think in some regards stems from a British lack of knowledge as to what its role is. I mean, that quip from Dulles in the 1950s, I think it was Dulles, that had lost an empire and was yet to find a role, it is not quite as true as it was post-Mrs. Thatcher. But these cultural traits die hard, and the British are still very much of the view that they are somehow superior to Americans. And I write this in the piece, too. So are Europeans, and they have been forever. I mean, Europeans thought that Americans were sort of stunted and stupid. They thought that their livestock was small and inedible and were destined to live shorter amounts of time. I mean, these ideas were actually written by brilliant people who were in every other way
Well, what was that guy's name again? Because I've read it as you've written it, but I can't even begin to pronounce the European scientist of the 18th century that you highlight here.
Hang on. He's got like a...
Buffon is the last name.
Yeah, I can't even remember.
I love how you call him the spectacularly named, and it goes on and on and on. I was thinking, man, that's got to, if they had business cards at that time, that would have been a huge one.
Yeah, I mean, he had a long exchange with Thomas Jefferson, because Thomas Jefferson was very irritated by his work, partly because Jefferson admired his general naturalism. And then he came up with this bizarre ideas about America. He is Count Georges-Louis Leclerc Buffon.
There's the guy!
Yeah.
I just looked that up.
It's all right, you pronounced it. That's all we were looking for.
Yeah. But no, I mean, in Notes on the State of, on the State of Virginia, Jefferson is in some regards trying to correct the record, because there is this widespread view in the salons of Paris and London that their cousins across the ocean are stunted and destined to be so forever. And of course, it must have annoyed Jefferson particularly, actually, because Jefferson was very tall, especially for the time. And so reading these otherwise intellectuals disparage Americans and their virility must have irritated them no end.
Charles C.W. Cook with us, Riley and Scott on WROK. Your family, at least a large portion of it, still across in Britain. What was it like to make the decision to be here permanently? What kind of reaction did you get from family members? And what was the deciding aspect for you that made you say, you know what, I think I'm going to leave. I think I'm going to be in the United States permanently.
I always thought I would do it, and I always said that I would do it. And I first visited America when I was 3, and I loved it. I just instantly loved it. And I do make the point in my piece, this is not inextricably linked from politics. In fact, my politics, if I had any, when I was growing up, were on the left, mm-hmm. or at least on that soft British left that believed that the National Health Service is the envy of the world and all guns should be banned and doesn't really question the size of government and so on. So this isn't really a political issue. It's just something about America that I can't describe. And I try at some point in the essay to describe it, and I eventually had to write that I don't know. And I don't know why Grand Central Terminal does what it does to me. I don't know why watching the space shuttle take off or listening to Etta James or reading the Declaration of Independence. I can grasp at intellectual reasons that I'm sure stand up to some extent, but then after a while, it's like trying to answer why you love your wife. You just do. So I was probably always going to come. That didn't make it easy, and especially moving at 26 years old, because you do have to acknowledge some things. I mean, I'm now getting married, and I live here, and I bought a house, and I have a job, and I have a career, and it's great. But there are some downsides. My sister's going to have her first child in 6 weeks, and I won't be there. I'll certainly be there for a week after the baby's born, mm-hmm. but it's not the same. My parents are, my mother's 60, my dad is 66, and I'm going to see them a lot less for the rest of their lives than I would if I lived 10 miles down the road. So, these things come with costs. Having said that, you've got to do what you've got to do, and I just always had to be here.
I think it's a wonderful piece. I think everybody should take a second, especially every American should take a second and read this, and look at what somebody who is not from here points out as being so cool about being here. You can be proud of your country and cheered by it without being jingoistic, and I think there's some great examples here.
Yeah. And I think the other mistake that a lot of Americans make, and this is probably a good thing in that they don't spend every waking minute thinking about how wonderful America is, and that they haven't experienced. And I'm from England, not Rwanda, so nor have I. But many of the people in the world live with horrors every day that it is probably good that Americans don't know about or think about. So I'm not suggesting that Americans should walk around always saying how beautiful their country is. Having said that, when you don't know anything else, it is quite easy to complain about little things. And if you zoom out and look at the world, this really is the most beautiful experiment. It's an experiment that contains features that no other country has. One of them, for example, is that it's the only country in the world in which you can speak and say pretty much anything, including sedition, and not be arrested. That's a beautiful and revolutionary thing. Secondly, it's really the only country in the world in which you can become an American. And when I become a citizen, which I'm not yet, enough time hasn't passed, and I tell people I am an American, nobody is going to say to me, well, no, you're not. But if I moved to France or India or Germany and said, I am French, they would say you're not. They'd say you're not Indian. It's just a different way of looking at the world. And that's unique. It's unique.
Charles C.W. Cook with us, National Review. My American Dream is his cover piece. You can also find him writing at nationalreview.com. And quickly, before we let you go, Charles, I want to make sure people tune into Gun Victories in the Midwest, your piece at nationalreview.com. And you reference what I know is one of your favorite pieces of audio from our esteemed governor, Pat Quinn. And in thanks of you joining us today, we're going to give it a spin here. This is Governor Pat Quinn here in Illinois talking about what he fears would happen if, and as now is,
yeah,
concealed carry were in place in Illinois.
I don't think that's healthy if you're going to the grocery store and you bump into somebody accidentally and they take offense, then they can pull out a loaded concealed handgun to assuage their anger.
Charles, how many of those words do you think he can actually spell?
Well, look, Chicago in particular and Illinois in general have been beaten up by the courts in recent years. I said to you before, the preposterous thing about Quinn there is that he's not talking in 1986 when this was first posited.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as if this hasn't been tried for 25 years in 49 other states, including some of which have gone to constitutional carry, and some have basically no gun laws at all, like Vermont, which incidentally I think has the lowest murder rate in the country. The fact that he would say that is preposterous, given the evidence. But even if it were, even if he were sort of channeling the general view of people in Illinois, which I don't think he is, but if he were, the courts have been beating him up. I mean, Illinois was forced to institute a concealed carry regime. He pushed it so far that the legislature said, you know, you're going to get us into even more trouble, and ignored him when setting up the system. And Chicago has just been one joy after another. I mean, Chicago was the city whose behavior led to the incorporation of the Second Amendment to the states in 2010. It's the city that's led to two very good precedent cases where the gun ban in the city, the gun sales ban in the city was struck down, and the firing range ban in the city was struck down. You know, as far as I'm concerned, if Chicago wants to keep teeing them up, amendment advocates like myself, and setting legal precedent, then that's fine.
Yeah, I don't know if you saw, I think it was during the day yesterday, Rahm Emanuel in Chicago said he's not even going to appeal the most recent ruling about gun stores in Chicago because he's tired of losing. So they might actually be learning something here, as hard as it is to believe.
Yeah, and he's not just tired of losing, I imagine, but he probably now understands what's happening. But when the Heller decision came down in D.C. in 2008, and then was incorporated in Chicago in 2010 so that it applied to the whole country, D.C. being a federal enclave and therefore potentially exempt, nobody quite knew the scale of it. Now, D.C.'s decision, which was that they can effectively keep guns banned except within the home, was a bad decision and a bad precedent. Nobody knows quite which way this would go if it went to the Supreme Court, but people were worried by that. People asked, is the Heller decision effectively hollow? And then along comes Chicago. And the first decision came down while Emanuel was mayor. He wasn't responsible for the firing range decision. And the second one he was responsible for. And his arguments were so weak that the judge not only set great precedents for Second Amendment rights, but slapped the city of Chicago down in no uncertain terms for having a weak argument, for not having thought it through, and for violating people's rights. So he probably has been told by people who are in the know, please stop doing this, because if these precedents go to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court agrees, then no city in the country is going to be able to do what you want to do. That's fine with me.
and us as well. Charles, as always, we truly appreciate you taking time out of your day. Love to read what you write. Love to follow you on Twitter as well. Have a fantastic weekend.
Absolutely. Good to talk to you.